are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 19th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marcy Wheeler, proprietor of the blog, emptywheel.net. On Mueller's investigation. What's new? What's real? What do we know? Meanwhile, red alert, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've called your senators. The Graham-Cassidy repeal and replace is for real. Lisa Murkowski could make the big difference, but there's a couple of people in play. Meanwhile, back in the Senate, Patty Murray dangles bipartisanship for an Obamacare patch. Hurricane Maria hammers Dominica with dire warnings for Puerto Ricans to evacuate. Back here, Obama buck rakes, and it's the where, not the how much. That is the big problem. Gorka's got a new gig. And have you heard the one about the murderous white supremacist who wants to fire his Jew and Indian lawyers? Well,
how can we help you?
You will today. All this and more on today's program. President Trump is at the UN, or was at the UN today. Because we have crossed the Rubicon. We've gone through the looking glass. And every satire ever written or discussed or performed has come true. So he was Donald Trump. Let me just repeat this. Was addressing the UN today. The first thing he did was to, I don't know how to characterize this. He gave a warning to North Korea, but not really to North Korea, to, of course, the Rocket Man.
No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
All right, pause it for one second. Now, the wording here is a little vague, but understand that the idea of having no choice but to totally destroy North Korea is basically threatening a war crime. You're not supposed to directly threaten to kill civilians. Obviously, this may just be a norm of war, but, you know, those things have become, have proven to, at the very least, in some way, mitigate the horrors of war. I mean, theoretically, I mean, that's what the UN is supposed to be about. And it's unclear, I say, because he sort of implies that he would only do that in the event that North Korea North Korea attacks the United States, that it's not in self-defense. But nevertheless, let's just dial it back and then go.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for.
I got to imagine there's some members of the United Nations who are sitting there just looking at their colleagues going, Rocket Man, what's he talking about? That moment honestly reminds me of when the former president, I guess, of Venezuela, Chavez, went up there and said, I've just come to the podium. Yesterday, the devil was here, and I can still smell the sulfur. At least that was more clever.
Oh, significantly more clever. It also wasn't attached to a promise to destroy the United States.
Yes, that's true. It also was like, I have no choice but to use this rhetoric. Because this is it. This is all I got. I really got him. I think the part about killing all the civilians wasn't enough, but when I called him Rocket Man, that is the one that really hurt.
It's the 1-2 punch. It works like that.
I just stuck the knife in and turned it. Assuming and then I also said I would kill all those North Koreans.
It's Rocket Man diplomacy.
At the Mar-a-Lago summit, we practiced Rocket Man diplomacy. Doug Hammerstein would be proud. It's true.
Now, with that aside, much of the speech, frankly, was not dramatically different from what you'd anticipate hearing from Obama in terms of actual substance. Obama wouldn't have said Rocket Man. He probably would have said Missile Guy.
Jew boy is on an occupation mission for himself. And if BB does not correct course, we'll have no choice but to melt down their yarmulkes. Moving on.
So,
but sending aid to our friends in Venezuela.
That's where we are on the sort of the Trump watch. In fact, let's play another clip. Here is Donald Trump complaining that, and this is really actually classic Donald Trump. As you know, he would often stiff contractors working for him. He never, ever paid his bills. Here, he's just complaining about it.
The United States is one out of 193 countries in the United Nations, and yet we pay 22% of the entire budget and more. In fact, we pay far more than anybody realizes. The United States bears an unfair cost burden. But to be fair, if it could actually accomplish all of...
I don't know what's going on in Zimbabwe. They cut to the Zimbabwe delegation, just sort of like, you got to be kidding me.
Wait, Mugabe's actually there himself.
Is that right?
That's Mugabe. Wow. I didn't realize that.
He seems to be looking Mugabe's on in genuine appreciation.
Yeah, the one with glasses, sort of with his head in his hand. He's in his upper 80s now.
But there are some incredibly poor countries sitting in the audience. There are countries who have been devastated by hurricanes or droughts or civil wars. And to hear Donald Trump whine that the United States pays 1/5 of the budget of the United Nations, it's got to be pretty.
When Barbuda can't even get the IMF to forgive a loan, they're like, we'll just re-up you. Definitely not forgive.
Payday loan type of thing. This one, you're going to get another one.
Yeah.
But let's continue, because Donald Trump is now going to move on to be fair.
We accomplish all of its stated goals.
Right.
if it could actually accomplish all of its stated goals, especially the goal of peace, this investment would easily be well worth it. Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell. But the powerful people in this room, under the guidance and auspices of the United Nations, can solve many of these vicious and complex problems. The American people hope that one day soon the United Nations can be a much more accountable and effective advocate for human dignity and freedom around the world. In the meantime, we believe that no nation should have to bear a disproportionate share of the burden, militarily or financially.
And by human dignity, I mean I'm going to kill everyone in North Korea.
Would that be more dignified? Earlier, had said, and this is, you know, whatever, typical Republican nonsense. But yes, he did earlier make the point, and it's true, that there's human rights violators that sit on the Human Rights Commission in the same speech where he overtly promised a war crime. I don't think Gaddafi ever did that. I actually don't think that might be a first at the UN.
That's a first. Yeah. Both complain about the failure of human rights and to, I mean, annihilating an entire country's worth of civilians seems like one of the top five human rights violations. But I would also add here that you've got Trump saying that we should be able to do this right. Another instance of him requiring others to do what he's not capable of doing. Like, I mean, his whole campaign was a function of, like, this is going to be easy. And he hasn't been able to do really anything. Maybe appoint a Supreme Court justice. But this same attitude of, like, just get it done. Make world peace. And then maybe we'd feel good about doing 20%.
The world not going to hell. Whoever would have thought it would have been so complicated.
Well, that's Donald Trump. We got to take a break. That's your president, ladies and gentlemen, at the United Nations. Sorry. Rest of the world.
Can I just give you 10
Sorry about that.
Can I just take 10 seconds? I just noticed that people who had zero, like, that's my country, that's my president sort of romanticism or West Wingism with Trump, whatever part of you that you realize didn't have that comes out, you're like, oh, my God, that is so embarrassing. Bush wasn't that embarrassing, right? I mean, I know he's embarrassing.
Bush was pretty embarrassing.
I get it, just but of Bush course, but not at that level, lower. Right?
Well, no, but I mean, you know, if we'd gone straight to Trump, it would have been pretty crazy.
Oh, I see what you mean. But I set the stage. Stage for Trump.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Marcy Wheeler. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Marcy Wheeler. She is, of course, the proprietor of the blog. I guess we still use that word, the site, emptywheel.net. Marcy, welcome to the program.
Always good to be on.
So, all right. There has been some interesting revelations, not just, I guess, over the past week, but particularly last night, that I think you understand the dynamic better than far most, I would say, is in my experience. Over the past week or so, we have found out that The Mueller investigation has received information from Facebook. It is unclear, and you seem to be skeptical of whether or not it got a warrant. Manafort, it's reported, had multiple FISA wiretaps on him. There was a second one that came out. Manafort was warned that he was going to be indicted. That Ty Cobb and McGahn had a public, I don't know what to call that. I mean, it's almost feels like it was faked.
There are people who think it was deliberately landing. Yeah, there are people who think that
was
deliberate.
All right, well, I want to go through all of these, but you tell me. And then Mueller apparently got a hold of a draft of the Comey firing letter, which may in some ways be related to the McGahn Ty Cobb show, if you will. But what's most of those things that have happened over the past couple of weeks? What's the most prominent, important piece of information that you've heard in terms of this investigation?
Well, I'll dismiss two, or at least we can bracket them and come back to them. Manafort stuff is exciting. Mueller is breathing down the neck of Paul Manafort, who, remember, was Trump's campaign advisor for a brief period. There's a newly disclosed FISA wiretap that may have picked up Trump, say, in January or February, because one of the most interesting details in that story is that Trump kept talking to this guy, even though both his lawyer and Manafort's lawyer were like, stop talking. So that, you know,
sometimes, Marcy, it's so hard to let go of your friends.
Well, I argued Trump needed to prove that he was being wiretapped, so he talked to somebody who was obviously a wiretap target.
He could have called Joey No Socks, right, or whatever, some of his buddies from the Atlantic City days, but I guess not. But all right, so
yeah, and then the interesting thing is when Manafort was searched in Virginia, the people who did the search said, "Oh yeah, we're going to indict you," but that doesn't seem like it's yet what's called a target letter, which is when your lawyer starts getting into negotiations with the prosecutor for some kind of plea deal or whatever. So, you know, that's a lot of show, which is to say that they're breathing down the neck of Manafort. Incidentally, one that you didn't mention, but you kind of need a cheat sheet to keep track of all of these, is they're also breathing down the neck of Mike Flynn. He right. yesterday announced a defense fund, which is, people may remember Scooter Libby had one. So he's asking for money because he's out of money and he's got to keep paying a lawyer. But that means that he hasn't flipped. And interestingly enough, in the last week, it was announced that Mueller is also breathing down the neck of Flynn Jr. And I pointed out yesterday that the way in which the defense fund is set up, the language of it at least, he could be sharing money with his son, too. So now they've got twice the legal teams to start paying for. So and to some degree, I think both of those reflect the same thing, which is Mueller is trying to be he's playing tough. He's clearly trying to get these guys to flip so he can start working his way up. And I think at this point, one would assume that neither one of them has, and that they're both saying to Mueller, we don't feel the need to. So that's where that is at.
Ask you this. When Mike Flynn starts a defense fund like that, is that his way of signaling that we haven't flipped? Or do they need to do that? I mean, is it... I mean, I don't know who they would signal to, but I'm just saying, like, you know, you're surmising that from a defense fund. I would imagine others surmise it. Is that why one does it? I mean, does it make, or is that just, you know, the equivalent of Mike Flynn coming out and saying, like, I haven't flipped?
I think that's a side effect of it. I mean, you know, in general, and this is an increasing theme of the coverage of this, the people being questioned and especially being kind of more closely targeted by the Mueller investigation, they're feeling the financial pinch right now. And to some degree, I'm somewhat sympathetic. These lawyers that do a good job of this stuff, and that doesn't include Trump's lawyers who were loudly talking about his case over a steak lunch, But the lawyers who are really good at this stuff are really expensive. And so if you want to solidly defend yourself against these accusations against a team, I mean, Mueller has 16 really good attorneys. That's what you're up against. If you want to go up against that team, you need the best. And they're like $1,200 an hour. And that adds up quickly. And unlike Michael Cohen, who's, by the way, his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee just got canceled because he broke the rules, which I'm kind of amused by. Paul Manafort, at least at times, has had millions and millions of dollars, although there were reports that he was in trouble even before the Trump, even before he started working for Trump, because of his past problems with a bunch of mobbed up, dirty politicians from other countries. So, you know, so unlike Cohen, unlike Manafort, unlike Trump himself, unlike Don Jr., unlike Kushner, none of those people are liquid, but they all have, you know, 8 digits, 9 digits of money to their name. Mike Flynn doesn't. And so right. it is unsurprising that he has a defense fund, because he's clearly right at the focus of this investigation. Mueller clearly wants him to flip. If he flips, then, you know, people like Kushner, I think, become clearly targeted. And so, so that's what's going on. I am genuinely sympathetic with the people. And you're hearing this more from lower down in the White House, these people who are like, why isn't Trump paying for my defense? You know, I have been loyal. I don't want to have to go cooperate with Mueller, but I don't have a choice because it's cost, you know, they're talking, they've spent $30,000 already without even getting to the grand jury, or testifying even to Congress. So it's a reality, and that is going to increasingly add pressure to at least the lower down people who don't have access to the kind of money that Trump's closest buddies have. One of the other interesting developments recently is Trump's fixer. What is his name? The guy, his security guy, quit
right.
The White House because he didn't have enough money. Well, he's being questioned, and so you're seeing these instances where people cannot pay a defense team on a White House salary. And so in that case, I'm sure he'll leave and be paid by Trump people. And that's their way to keep him quiet. Remember, he's the guy who fired Comey or delivered the Comey
right.
firing letter.
The big tall guy who looks like, almost like a, let me just ask you this. I mean, when you read a piece like that, and I've read those where it's, you know, people are like, I've been loyal to Trump and I'm getting drained from my cash. I may have to go cooperate. Isn't that sort of like a red flag? Like, why wouldn't you cooperate? I mean, how does being loyal to Trump mean not cooperating with this investigation? Or is it just if you cooperate, you give the, you know, Mueller something to make much ado about nothing?
I think that probably depends on who you're talking about. I think that, If there's nothing to hide.
Right. I mean, it's just a weird case to make. Like, I may have to go talk to the investigators about this if I don't get paid off. I mean, it's a weird thing to sort of signal in public, because it sort of implies like there's a value to me not talking. I mean, I don't know. It seems weird to me, but that's just a weird defensive posture to take.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I think that as your listeners read all of this coverage, they should. I generally beat up on Ben Wittes, but he did a pretty good post a couple weeks back on how to read these things. And he was mostly interested in how to read the sourcing of it. He was basically arguing that Mueller's attorneys aren't talking, and I think that's probably right. But as you read these things, it's important to remember who can talk to the press and why they might talk to the press.
Right.
And in high-profile cases like this, and this was true, very true of the Scooter Libby case, a way for people who are under the gun, whether they're actual targets or whether they're, witnesses who might hurt the targets, a way for them to communicate without it being obstruction is for them to go to the press. And so a lot of what we're seeing, which is very exciting to us, is messaging and or attempts to work the press. Michael Cohen was very good at this when he released his admission, basically, that he was working on a Trump Tower and, you know, talking to Dmitry Peskov. He very successfully, I think, preempted that in the press, and the press got distracted from the questions they might otherwise have looked at. And so, we are getting a lot of leaks from Congress, I think. We are getting a lot of leaks from, you know, maybe people tied to the FBI because parts of the FBI leak like a sieve. I don't think we're getting any leaks from the Mueller team. And therefore, you know, most of what we're seeing is very motivated for defense people or for, you know, the White House or for, and it's, that's really important to keep in mind as you're trying to suss out what these articles
you
are
know,
doing.
I definitely wanted that. I'm glad you addressed that because I had questions about like, how is it that we know about a FISA wiretap? How is it that we know these things? So let's go through that. What do you think is the most important revelation? Is it the dual FISA warrants? Is it of these revelations? And we can get back to some of those earlier ones. But what do you think is the most important to the extent that there has been any important revelations over the past couple of weeks?
Well, I'm actually more interested in the lawyer one. So what happened was John Dowd and Ty Cobb, who are Trump's lawyers for dealing with this, were out at a fancy steak lunch and a New York Times reporter was two tables away. And they were both very loudly. There was no martinis on the table in the picture that he took. This is Ken Vogel, the New York Times.
We're actually looking at the picture now. It just seems to be some type of spring water. And unclear whether it was with gas or without gas, but go ahead.
Oh, I think that's definitely gas. I think that's the brand will come to me in a second. I like that kind of water. But regardless, there are no martinis on the table. So there's no, like, it's not like they were drunk and they just were mouthing off. But they basically made it clear that there is a disagreement within the White House between them, who work for Trump, and Don McGahn, who is the White House counsel, on how forthcoming to be with Mueller. And they, you know, made some crack about having, about McGahn having spies in their team. They made some crack about McGahn having two documents in his safe that he's holding on to. And basically suggested Cobb and Dowd were both like, yeah, we're giving everything over to Mueller. We're being very forthcoming and McGahn is not. And that's interesting for a couple of reasons. I mean, Mueller has already told McGahn that he and a deputy will be called to testify. And they can be. We keep going back to the earlier presidential scandals, but this is a precedent that was set in the Bill Clinton scandals that the White House counsel works for us, whereas Cobb and Dowd work for Trump.
Okay.
And so he can be called to testify. His deputy can be called to testify. And that's interesting for a number of reasons, but most importantly, and I think you alluded to this, that when Trump wanted to fire Comey, he got together at a golf course because that's where he does business. And they decided they were going to fire him. He drafted a letter, Trump did, and gave it to McGahn. And McGahn's like, whoa, you can't release this. And that's part of what led to Rod Rosenstein, who's now the Deputy Attorney General, and Jeff Sessions, kind of trumping up, inventing this excuse, which is that they were firing Jim Comey because of all the blathering he did during the campaign and that he was still not backing down about how inappropriate all that was.
What do you think was in that letter that Don McGahn said? And we should say Don McGahn was also famously hot tub Tom DeLay's counsel, if I remember correctly. What was in that letter that made Don McGahn? What do you think was in that letter that made Don McGahn say, like, you can't print, you can't publish, you can't use this letter?
Well, I think it was that Trump laid out that he had asked Comey to tell him he wasn't under investigation.
Okay.
I suspect it's the way in which he framed that and the way in which it made it clear that he was asking for loyalty, because
the letter basically said, like, I am firing you because I am obstructing justice, essentially, right? I mean, and Don McGahn said, yeah, you can't say that because they could come after you for obstructing justice.
Well, not even that, but also, I mean, already it is clear that the White House is tampering too much in DOJ's business in prosecutions. And so, I think that that doesn't look good either. But McGahn told the president, no, you can't send this. And ultimately, that letter was shared with Rosenstein and Sessions. And it is understood that Rosenstein and Sessions are the ones who turned that over, and only very recently. Hmm. And that suggests that one of the things that it's clear McGahn has been doing, based on the testimony of people like Dan Coats, who's the director of national intelligence, Mike Rogers, director of NSA, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, they've gone to Congress and been asked questions, and they've said, well, I don't know if I can answer that. And they've kind of invoked soft privilege. They haven't invoked executive privilege, which, remember, protects conversations with the president, deliberative conversations with the president. They haven't invoked executive privilege. They've sort of said, I think it might be executive privilege, so I'm not going to answer the question. And it's clear that's been McGahn's gig. And one of the things that it seemed that Dodd and Cobb were pointing to was that McGahn is sort of doing the same with some of the discovery for Mueller. They're saying we want to give it all to Mueller. And McGahn is saying, these conversations between me and the president, I'm not sure I can hand over. And now what's interesting is Mueller already has that letter. You already mentioned that, right? Mueller mm-hmm. already has the letter, the draft letter that McGahn said, well, you can't send. So then the question is, what are the other two documents in this safe? And the firing of Comey is one thing we know McGahn was involved with. But I'm also interested because remember that Sally Yates, who was the deputy attorney general, she's the one who got fired because she refused to defend Trump's Muslim ban.
Yep.
Sally Yates, actually in the days leading up when she got fired, had gone to Don McGahn and said, you guys got a problem with Mike Flynn. And she laid out some of the counterintelligence problems, meaning some of the ties that Flynn had with Russia. And she laid out enough about what Flynn had said in his FBI interview that led DOJ to be very concerned. And that didn't result in a firing. That did not result in Mike Flynn's firing, which is what she expected it would do. And so there may be some interesting stuff there. And there with regards to whether or not he should have been fired. And then the one other thing that came out in recent weeks is that the White House decided that Jared Kushner should resign.
Right.
This was in the summer. And the story that revealed that was very interesting because it said a bunch of lawyers and then the denials, and I think it was Dowd, but it might have been Cobb. It was one of the lawyers who's working directly for Trump said, well, the lawyers working for Trump did not recommend that Kushner be fired, be forced to resign. And it made it clear that people like McGahn and his deputy and Mark Kaslowitz, who was ousted after this, Mark Correll wasn't a lawyer, but he was the spokesperson for this team then, that those people got ousted in part because they all said, you get rid of Kushner and you get rid of one of the exposures to Trump. And Trump's people said, no, we don't need to do that. We don't need to admit that Kushner has this kind of exposure. And that's interesting because there have, I mean, I raised the point earlier that Manafort was so, oh, Trump kept talking to Paul Manafort even after the time when Manafort was being wiretapped under FISA.
Hmm.
And we saw something. What is interesting is there's a report somewhere, and I'm sorry I can't point to exactly where it is, but it's out there, I promise. It may be New York Times report today. Made it clear that Kushner has continued to talk to Trump about this investigation, at least up until the point where these concerns were raised in July, and the intimation is still. So in other words, you've got Kushner, who I think is very closely targeted in this investigation, and his father-in-law, who are still talking about the investigation. And that's going to be a problem. That's going to raise some concerns. So those are things that I think Don McGahn may be exposed for and may be trying to protect. And meanwhile, Trump's personal lawyers are trying to suggest to Mueller that McGahn is obstructing himself. I also think McGahn, certainly at the beginning of this process, and I think since, has done some really stupid lawyering, and so he may be he may not want that to come out, but we'll see whether it does.
And so Trump's lawyers would do that because you want to throw anything at Mueller that is not your client, essentially.
Right. And their strategies are different. And it is true that McGahn has the equities of the president to consider in a way that Dodd and Cobb simply don't. I mean, there were decisions, for example, that President Obama made, no big scandal like this, but there were decisions that President Obama made that I think were made in significant part out of consideration for the institution of the presidency, which were, really aggravating. But that is what people do when they get in the White House, is they start to protect that institution and in so doing protect their predecessors and their successors in ways that we wouldn't necessarily like.
Okay. And so what is your assessment as to whether or not, was that really just two guys who just didn't realize where they were and how loud they were being? I mean,
I do think you need to consider the possibility that it was intentional. I mean, it makes them look terrible. It makes them look like they're violating ethics laws, rules. I mean, this is how lawyers stay. This is how lawyers are disciplined, is all of these ethics rules that are supposed to bind them. I do think that it makes them look terrible. But if it helps, I mean, this White House, the backbiting in this White House is so thick, right? And if it helps them win that fight within the White House, maybe they think that it's all good for Trump. Maybe that's the logic.
Somebody in the press they can like leak that to, though?
Yeah, you would think, right? Well, I think that, you would think they would do it that way. But and some of that, frankly, is what the story about firing Kushner was.
Right. That was leaking just to sort of. I've heard some people sort of attribute that to Bannon, to lay more of the responsibility onto Kushner. I mean, it seems like, it's almost would be surprising to find out that a lot of these reporters aren't getting the same information from two different sources that are, on different sides of whatever I want to say the fence, but it seems like the fence is just sort of meandering there. There's not just two teams. There seem to be like 30 different factions within
right,
the administration.
Right, there's two legal teams, and then there's two ideological teams, right? There's Bannon, who thinks he needs to protect Trump's nativism and protectionism, and he is going to continue to push that now that he's out. Would it extend to, cooperating with Mueller against Kushner? That would be interesting, and I wouldn't rule anything against Bannon, right? Would he go to Mueller and say, here, let me give you all the dirt on Kushner? There's still this, there was this anonymous letter handed to the Washington Post last December. And even at the time, Bannon was considered a possibility for where that letter came from. And I think given everything we've seen since, I raised the question again, but I agree that, and as more people, like Trump, I think, finally figured out that he has to stop firing people in the White House or they're all going to become, liberated or interested in protecting themselves. I think Rince Priebus could be in that position. I think Sean Spicer is trying to, reclaim his reputation, obviously.
Right.
And as people do that, would they flip on? I mean, Spicer is not a loyalist to Trump. So we'll see what he's willing to talk to Mueller about. But the important thing to understand, I think, is that Trump's people, and Trump doesn't have great lawyers for this, because no lawyers of the ilk that normally take these cases. Like, again, I covered the Scooter Libby case, and just about everyone in that case was lawyered up very, very well, and Dick Cheney especially. Even Bush, I mean, he lawyered up for that. And Trump doesn't have that kind of lawyer because they don't. That kind of lawyer doesn't expect Trump will pay them.
We saw that reports a couple of months ago. There was a report specifically about that, that everybody was afraid they were going to get stiffed. And I imagine some people say, well, I would never, but it's because they thought they were going to get stiffed.
And also that Trump is impossible client.
Right.
The guy won't take orders, and therefore you don't want to be that lawyer. And Don Jr.'s lawyer as well, he's an old mob lawyer. He's not a Washington political scandal lawyer. And so the approach of old mob lawyers is omerta, right? You make sure that nobody cooperates with the investigation, and that's how you'll bust it, right? And Mueller has, I don't know what percentage of the 16 lawyers he's got working for him are mob prosecutors, but probably four have that kind of experience, including himself. Get this to work better.
Yeah, that's better. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that, but that's better. So he's got these subpar lawyers, and unfortunately for him, Mueller has at least several attorneys on his staff who are prosecutors who have been used to working with sort of a mob psychology. I mean, I'm talking literally the mafia, I guess, psychology and the way that they defense against these. So let me ask you this about, one of the things that was revealed in the past week was that Mueller has gone to Facebook and supposedly, and you seem to be skeptical about this based upon what I've read of yours, that he would have needed a warrant to get this information from Facebook. And one of the, just to give some background for people, the theories that has come out is that collusion, to the extent that there was any, could have been a targeting by Cambridge Analytics, or Analytica, I guess, which was the Mercer Bannon-owned, data firm. And they provided essentially the coordinates. These are the people you need to hit. And the Russians, whatever that means, provided sort of the manpower to flood these Facebook feeds. And before anybody, the collusion theory, who knows? But the idea that you can impact voter behavior via Facebook is well, has been, that premise has been tested. There was an experiment, I guess, in 2010, in the 2010 election, that moved several hundred thousand voters. 340,000 people extra turned out to vote in the 2010 congressional races because of Facebook messages. So there is reason to believe that this would be a decent strategy, but not necessarily one that was taken up by Cambridge Analytics or Russians. But give me your sense of these stories that have broken about it.
Well, I before people attack Facebook too much, Obama would not have gotten elected without his Facebook work. I mean, he really led the way on precisely what Trump did to suppress turnout, but he used it to increase turnout. And so there is a good side to this Facebook stuff that we should remember as we talk about it.
Right.
I think here's the thing about the Facebook stuff. I think that we'll find more interesting connections with Twitter. And thus far, Twitter has not offered up any data. That's a little bit, I mean, Twitter has a much smaller footprint, but I think that's where Russian coached influencers really pushed other influencers, to take up certain memes. That's a lot harder to track, but my suspicion is, and I would throw in 4chan there, that you need to see how anonymous people really planted these memes that then turned into Pizzagate. And that's one of the things that I think we need to trace back. And we haven't done that yet. What we know thus far about Facebook is Facebook says $100,000 in ads were paid for by this troll farm in St. Petersburg. And everyone says, well, you can do a lot with $100,000, and that is true, except that ignores the scope of the spending in this election. So Hillary ran a $1 billion campaign. She spent millions of dollars. She had 200 people on her digital campaign, not including David Brock, who had his own online crowd.
Right.
You can argue that Hillary's spending on those things was poorly spent, and I would argue that. But when we're talking the scale of this election, to suggest $100,000 is more than throwing matches on top of the bonfire that Republicans were already spending, needs more evidence. And the evidence we have thus far on the actual ads tied to that troll farm is they were, that there's no way you could argue they were effective for the election. They, you know, one of them got four people to turn out to an anti-immigrant march in Idaho. That's not a good thing. I'm not defending that. But you're not going to swing a presidential election by changing the behavior of four people in Idaho. It's the third most Republican state, right? I'm interested in what happened in Michigan and Wisconsin, because it is true that Facebook appeals in Michigan and Wisconsin probably could be enough to flip those states because the states were so close. You could argue the same is true in Pennsylvania. The thing is that Trump has already said they paid for those. Trump has already bragged about sending out those. And they're not, those aren't ad per se. Those are dark ads. So A, you're not seeing them. But B, Trump has already taken credit for them. And he took credit for them based on the enormous spending. And again, this is why I point to scale, based on the enormous spending of the Mercers.
Right.
So we know where some of that came from.
And why
the other
would,
thing I pointed,
why would, let me just ask, what I don't understand is, I mean, I understand the idea of like, look, we have this targeting information, and but we just don't have the manpower to sort of like create all these fake accounts that would actually be staffed by real people. And so I understand the idea that like maybe you would go to a, I don't know, you know, your buddies who stole all those credit cards, you know, that you're hanging around with in, you know, Joey No Socks's crew or Felix Sater's crew, you know, in Macedonia or Russia, wherever it is, and just be like, hey, can you get those guys who steal all those credit cards and do the phishing emails? Can you get them to just be fake Facebook guys? I can understand why you would need the stat, like the human, like the bodies. But it seems to me like $100,000, why would you need Russia to do that on your behalf? Right? I mean, you can't find somebody to do, you got the money. You can't get the Mercers to pay that money?
Right. And that's the point I keep making is like, again, the scale of money that was already sloshing around here is so vast that I don't, I mean, Trump was, he ran his election on the cheap. It is true. And that's partly because the press gave him so much free advertising. But I, you know, I don't think it was money. And then the other thing that I keep pointing out, we already know where the collusion happened. We know. And that is that the figure Guccifer 2.0, who has been, you know, the intelligence community says he was a Russian front, shared a bunch of state-level DTRIP, so DCCC, DCCC, the Congressional Committee, documents such that they came out in the state where they would affect the election. And some of that data was actually useful for targeting. And so I think we're thinking of it entirely wrong. The notion that you couldn't figure out targeting, the Russians couldn't, unless they got direction from Trump. It is true. Trump did his targeting far better than Hillary in this election. So you could argue that. But we already know that the Russians were taking information they stole from Hillary and the Democrats and making it available to Republicans. So I suspect that the direction went in the opposite direction, that the Russians stole information from Democrats and provided useful information that would be useful for targeting to Republicans. That's where I think it went to.
Can you just, for those of us who aren't, you know, deeply immersed in this, tell us just briefly, who is Guccifer and how do we know that Guccifer was directed by the Russians in some fashion?
So Guccifer 2.0 is, somebody started a WordPress blog the day after the Washington Post first revealed that a security contractor called CrowdStrike was in the DNC servers. So the very next day, this WordPress blog comes out. Somebody named Guccifer 2.0, who was naming himself after an earlier hacker who had targeted Hillary, says, it was me, it wasn't the Russians, but did certain things like deliberately left metadata to leave Cyrillic, to leave a tribute to the head of the FSB, the inventor of the FSB, basically. And what that first blog post did was prove the claims that the DNC and CrowdStrike made to Washington Post were wrong. They said only two documents were taken. Somebody shows up the next day and says, look at all these documents I've got. Now, what's interesting is none of those documents were DNC documents. Those were actually Podesta and probably Hillary documents. So we now know that that person was not only proving DNC and CrowdStrike wrong, but was also saying, look, I've got a ton more documents than you know about or that you're admitting to. Why do we know that person is Russian? Well, I mean, this is one of the most contentious things, is there are skeptics who say Guccifer was probably X, Y, or Z, somebody else trying to blame the Russians. If you look at Guccifer's later behavior, again, I said that entity was leaking DTRIP documents. That would seem to rule out a Bernie supporter. It would seem to rule out the DNC. It would seem to rule out CrowdStrike. They have no incentive to help Republicans get elected and no incentive to release those documents. Guccifer 2.0, right before the election, was basically elevating Russian memes. So at that point, Guccifer 2.0 said, well, Hillary's going to try and tamper with the election. I'm going to prevent it. Any of you hackers want to help me do X, Y, and Z? We know that at the time, or we've been told, again, we're trusting the IC on this, but again, this, I think there is more evidence now in the public record to support. We know that the Russians were also trying to hack things like voting books, things that could make it hard and may have in North Carolina. Things that could make it harder. You could basically slow down the voting in more Democratic areas. Durham County, which is the most Democratic area in North Carolina, had their polling books work funny. And so just in that county, they switched to paper. The entire rest of the state still using the electronic books. Durham County, the most Democratic part of the state, they're using paper. It is creating lines. And that is, if you want to affect elections, that's how you do it. I mean, that's how the Republicans do it, too, is they make sure that, you know, that precincts that are predominantly people of color, that they have to show ID, and that precincts that are predominantly white don't. And that means it's a lot easier and it takes a lot less time for white people to vote than black people to vote. You know, that they've been doing that in American
that's
elections.
That's a tried and true process. We saw it in 2004 in Ohio. And I mean, I assume you see it other places, too, but it's most prominent in these states that end up being swing states where you see, oh, we used to have four voting machines there. Now we only have two because two broke and we didn't have time to fix them or something.
Oops.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's sort of, so anyway, that is my short case for Guccifer 2.0 being Russian.
Okay.
I think there's more there. I think, I'm happy to agree with the skeptics that I think some of the initial things said about Guccifer 2.0 were rash and should be revisited and people should admit that they made the wrong statements. I don't at all dismiss the skepticism out of bound. I think the case is still persuasive that Guccifer 2.0 is tied to the Russians.
Okay. So your point being that we already, at the very least, a significant point of collusion and, you know, creating other theories are secondary at this point because you have at least the evidence there. But That is, you know, it's one thing to get it to, like, you know, the people who got that that information, they didn't know they were dealing with a Russian, right? And, you know, to the extent that there's, I mean, and we should make this clear that, like, you know, obviously the United States government has influenced other elections. I don't know if they've done something to this effect, but they certainly have gone as far as maybe, you know, in certain places, getting rid of the opposition, like literally. But be that as it may, there's not necessarily a sort of two parties entering into an agreement with both an awareness of who each other was in this instance, right? I mean, so that's what Mueller needs to find on some level.
Right. And one of the more interesting areas that he presumably is pursuing is that there was this story about a now deceased Republican. Am I allowed to say the RF word on this? I forget.
RF? Oh, ratfuck. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, good, because I got in trouble saying it on TV. So this ratfucker who goes back to the Clinton days, the Bill Clinton days, was looking for the Clinton Foundation emails and was actually approaching Russian hackers for it. The people who were involved with him in it include Roger Stone, include Chuck Johnson, who has close ties to the White House. So it includes this network of rat fuckers, some young, some, you know, Roger Stone, who's been rat fucking longer than Vladimir Putin. And they were in discussions with Guccifer 2.0 as well. So you have there, I think, clear cases where people were knowingly soliciting Russians for some kind of dirt against Hillary. And we don't hear as much about that. We may soon, because Roger Stone, I think, is testifying this week to Congress. But that is an area where you have actual GOP ratfuckers who have some, you know, some plausible deniability with the campaign, but we're clearly working on behalf of the campaign, who are reaching out to known Russian entities trying to get more dirt on Hillary.
Okay, so let me just ask you these two questions here. The Facebook information. A lot of people are reporting this as if that information was handed over because Mueller had a warrant. The implications of that supposedly are that Mueller's had to prove to some type of court that a warrant is justified here, and that there's proof of a crime being having been committed. You are skeptical that he had a warrant, and just tell me what the implications of that are, one way or another.
Yeah, the reason I'm skeptical is just the way those stories are built. They say Facebook turned over more to Mueller. They needed process. Here's Facebook's privacy policy. And we assume, looking at the privacy policy, that they would require a warrant. And I don't think that they do all of the work to get there. I had this conversation with a bunch of surveillance lawyers yesterday, and none of them could agree. And they're some of the smartest people in the country on this. But I think that what is really underlying this is that Congress, particularly Adam Schiff and Mark Warner, they want Facebook to go and use Facebook's tools to figure out what happened. And Facebook did. And it's actually pretty amazing. Facebook, I keep saying, is like, it has the global intelligence capabilities that most state SIGINT agencies would love to have. You know, it's not as good as NSA's, but it's probably as good as France's. Wow. And, right? And yeah. So does Google. I mean, that's how we need to think of these companies now, is they have a global footprint. They have that kind of forensics. They've tracked that kind of forensics to protect their own networks, and they have the ability to learn certain things about what happened within their networks. And Facebook, as they tell it, of their own accord, with some cajoling from Mark Warner, went and tried to figure this out. Tried to, you know, did stuff that the NSA couldn't do because they can't access the NSA in that way. And that's pretty amazing, but Mark Warner and Adam Schiff aren't happy with what Facebook has done. So one of the things they're trying to do is to shame Facebook publicly, and there's good reason to shame them, so that they'll go back and do more. And there is no legal process by which Congress or even Robert Mueller can order Facebook to go do this kind of analysis. And frankly, Mark Warner and Adam Schiff have never asked NSA to do it. You know, they haven't asked NSA to go do the same kind of analysis, much less intrusive analysis, and figure out how many of us are being spied on under 702. So So it is a remarkable request. And I think what they actually realize is there is no legal process. I mean, they haven't issued Facebook a subpoena yet.
Right.
And when they're saying, well, you know, Mueller had to use more process. Yeah, of course he did. But Mueller has very ready access to grand jury orders. And it maybe that's all he needed. What's called D order, 2703 D order, which gives you business records. But it got this narrative out there, which is that Facebook isn't being cooperative enough and they need to hand over more willingly. And the legal issues, quite frankly, are pretty, pretty complex, especially when you're sharing with Congress. They're not as complex with Mueller. And as I said, Mueller could use Section 702. Because everything we're talking about is a foreign entity, very easily and get a lot of this information. But for Congress, it is a complex question, and we wouldn't want to set a precedent where, you know, Trey Gowdy can tell Facebook to go find right. all of the peace activists in the country. That right. would be horrible, and that's the kind of request that Warner and Schiff are trying to shame Facebook into delivering on. Because they have no legal process for it. And frankly, I'm not sure we want them to have that legal
right.
process.
I see what you're saying. So they want this to be uniquely a unique situation. And the only way to do that is to sort of make it a political or PR campaign. Because if you set up the institutional process, there's a lot more opportunity for this thing to be abused in ways that we may not like when they start to, you know, see how President Gillibrand got into office in 2022 well, or whatever it is. All right. So let me ask you this.
Gillibrand 2020. Don't,
well, I know, but the investigation is going to happen around 2022. That's where I was at. So,
oh, okay. Well, I'm not even arguing they've gone that far. I'm just saying that there is no legal process right now. Because we haven't really thought about what it means that these companies and
have
I'm
this,
not sure
have
Twitter
this ability.
Has the same
no, I yeah, I get what you're saying. Like we the law has not caught up to the technology and its abilities in this point. When we're talking about a private entity, and I mean it's a very strange world we live in some ways. All right, well, let me just ask you secondly about the Manafort FISA. Okay. What does it mean? He had two FISA warrants on him. One seems to be completely unrelated to the Trump campaign. The second one is or is not. And how do we know this? I mean, who knows that there's a FISA warrant that would tell us?
My guess is it's more congressional leaking. A lot of these, you know, again, your listeners should remember there are two obvious sources for a lot of this. The first is defendants and people close to them. The second is members of Congress because they have some legal protections. They can say speech and debates protects them against leak prosecutions in a way that that's less true of somebody in the executive branch. People within the White House are also leaking this, whether or not they've already been called. I think that there are parts of the FBI that are leaky as the sieve. I assume that Mueller's investigation is not.
Well, so when you say Congress, are we talking like Democrats who think like, okay, it'll be good for people in the White House to know that Manafort has been under a FISA surveillance, order and surveillance, because that's going to make them sweat in the White House? Or is it, you know, like a David Nunes type who's basically saying like, hey, guys, stop talking. I mean,
it can be both. It can honestly be both. And this, you know, of course, Trump is using it to prove that he was wiretapped. One of the actual interesting things about this, Sam, is so Manafort, according to the CNN report, and these are good justice reporters, so they've reported some of the key details in other FISA orders. So Manafort, as you said, was under one FISA order because he's a corrupt influence peddler, okay, because he was working for corrupt Ukrainian oligarchs, and he was perceived as doing their bidding sufficiently that he was deemed an agent of a foreign power. Now, interestingly, so was the Podesta group, Tony Podesta, not mm-hmm. John, but two other influence peddling groups, sleazy influence peddling groups, are kind of being dragged in with Manafort, and the Podesta group is one of them. So, you know, I don't want Democrats to think they're all in the clear, because Tony right. Podesta is the same kind of sleazy influence peddler that Manafort is. So that's why he had an order on him prior to this, and it wasn't producing anything, so it lapsed, basically. And then sometime after these revelations from last summer came about, FBI was able to go back and get another FISA order. And one of the things I find interesting about this is that there was an explicitly known criminal investigation into Paul Manafort already by that point, right? We knew that Manafort was under investigation for money laundering tied to his donations to these corrupt Ukrainian oligarchs. And instead of using a criminal warrant, according to the report in CNN, they went back and got another FISA order. And that's interesting to me. I haven't thought through all that means. But one of the things, and this is going to surprise your listeners probably, one of the things I think it may mean is that criminal warrants almost never get sufficiently minimized. You have to say what you're looking for. You have to say, I'm going to go search Manafort's flat in Trump Tower, three blocks down from Trump's office. I'm going to have a wiretap on this phone of Paul Manafort. So you have to kind of describe it more specifically. But once you suck it in, that stuff all gets sucked in forever. Whereas some FISA orders, there is reason to believe that the FISA court gets more involved in some of these orders and says, you can access this, but not this. You can access this up until such a time, but you have to do minimization on it because it's going to suck up other people. That's counterintuitive, I know, but there are actually areas where the FISA court is more protective of privacy than criminal courts are. And criminal courts are every bit as much rubber stamps as are the FISA court, probably okay. even more so. So it's actually possible that this FISA order came with what is called a clean team to prevent political discussions from being sucked into this criminal/intelligence investigation.
So, in other words, people were worried like, oh, we don't want to get Donald Trump talking about strategy with Paul Manafort on this because it's a bad look. You know, we shouldn't be doing that. And that's why they would have gone after the FISA warrant as opposed to a criminal one.
Well, I don't know why they went after the FISA warrant and not the criminal warrant. And I think that should be one of the interesting questions because they already presumably had the probable cause to get the criminal warrant and they chose instead to get the FISA warrant. I'm still thinking that through, but that to my mind is one of the questions that should be asked in light of yesterday's report.
Interesting. Well, Marcy Wheeler, I can't thank you enough. I feel like this stuff flies so quickly, and it's tough to follow. And 45 minutes talking to you about it, I feel like I have a much better grip on what's going on. Obviously, there's a lot of we don't know. The unknowns are unknown, I think, as Rumsfeld said. But I feel like we know a lot more, and hoping to talk to you again soon about this. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Sam. Always fun.
All right, folks. And I should remind everybody, if Marcy referred back a couple of times to Scooter Libby, Marcy wrote the definitive book for you youngins. Scooter Libby was the chief of staff of Dick Cheney. And there was there was basically, as the Iraq war wore on and towards the end of the Bush administration, people wanted to know how we were lied into the Iraq war and who gave what information to whom. And it had involved Dick Cheney's office and a reporter from the New York Times. And Marcy Wheeler covered the trials in this case. And Scooter Libby ultimately had his sentence commuted, if I remember correctly. He was not pardoned. I think he was sentence commuted. Marcy covered that in a way that really, I mean, the job she did on that actually, I think, changed the dynamic between blogs and newspapers at that time. This is 2007. Because there suddenly people had an awareness like, oh, wow, she has outpaced the New York Times, which, you know, had a little bit of a problem because one of their former reporters was involved in this. But the Washington Post, every major publication probably in the world was outpaced by her coverage. And you can read that book. It's called Anatomy of Deceit, How the Bush Administration Used the Media to Sell the Iraq War and to Out a Spy. This involved also, gosh, her name escapes me now, but her husband was an ambassador.
Valerie Plame.
Yes, Valerie Plame and her husband, Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson was sent to Niger to investigate the claims of yellow cake uranium going to Iraq. He came back and he said, no. And the Bush administration, perhaps as a way of just punishing him, outed his wife, who was a CIA spy. So it's all in there. Check it out. I mean, it's really an incredible story. Matt, have you listened to that book? Have you consumed that one?
I was not aware that she had written a book. I'm going to, though.
Yeah. It's Anatomy of Deceit. And like I say, it also, in addition to giving you an incredible look into how the Bush administration lied us or sold us, sold the media on an Iraq war, it was also really changed the way I think that bloggers were perceived. I mean, that was sort of the end of the, oh, you're just in your pajamas in the basement. Pajama boys. Speaking of which, we're going to take a break and we're going to head into the fun half and talk about Gorka's comeback. On whose defense? He's, I mean, almost, it's almost like you couldn't make this stuff up. The guy who he's campaigning for now in Alabama. Folks, a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. Every day I get an email or two from people who are, I got to hold off on my membership now because I'm going through some tough times. You folks replenish that by when our free listeners become members to support the program. You can do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support makes this show possible. If you become a member, you get a bunch of extra content and you get the show commercial free. Sometimes we have commercials. Still, 97.3% of our revenue comes from members. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy stuff from Amazon or Jet.com, do so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on that link. Keep it in a special place. Always use that link to buy your stuff. You will see no difference. We will get a kickback. Folks, we will see you tomorrow or in the fun half, 646-257-3920.
She says no, 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 no. I give her my heart. She says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only a friend to me. Only a brother to me. Says no, 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 no. Just a little dog, and she knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me,
says you're only afraid to lose me. Only a brother to me. She's a pretty little girl. She says no, 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 no. All the night time through, she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to walk. Cheers.